Good morning, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. This is WILF's wake-up call, WILF being the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And we're here every Friday morning from 7:30 to 8 o'clock bringing you the very hot and interesting news of the day. I want to remember this time to tell you to please have your pen or pencil and paper ready, because we always give you some ways to get more information about whatever our topic is so you can understand it as much as you can. We're going to talk today about healthcare reform and where we are. And we have a longtime activist working for more than 15 years on getting some kind of healthcare reform. He's a professor emeritus from the School of Medicine at UNC. It's Dr. John Hammond. And we're so delighted that you were able to come and share your information and understanding of healthcare reform with us today.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to do three things today. One is to talk about the history of health insurance briefly, the status prior to the passage of the bill, and the status of health insurance after the passage. It's important to understand that health insurance is a relatively recent phenomenon, in Germany dating from Otto von Bismarck and in the United States dating from about 1930. Between 1930 and 1940, it became possible to survive being hospitalized and treated in a hospital. Prior to that, hospitals were more like hospices, where you went to die, so there was therefore no need for insurance, except life insurance. The advent of antibiotics, anesthesia, and other technical advances made it possible to survive. And by the 30s, the medical community, actually the surgeons, started nonprofit health insurance companies that we now know as Blue Cross Blue Shield. They started as separate entities. One paid for hospital inpatient care, the other paid for physician fees. And then later they merged together. And for many years, up until about 1960, they all were on the not-for-profit model. It began to change in the mid-50s to the early 60s when the for-profit insurance companies, who had always stayed away from health insurance because they did not have a good way to control adverse risk, so they elected to stay out of it. But then they decided to get into it, and instead of using what was called community rating, which the nonprofits did, which means that you take your total cost for the state of North Carolina, for example, with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you divide it by the number of enrollees, and that's your premium, plus an administrative expense. The for-profits, though, decided to do the automobile insurance model, liability insurance, and base the premium on risk, which totally destroys the concept of insurance, which is if you have the largest pool of people, you minimize the costs. Well, what they did was they offered the healthy and usually young very cheap rates, and then charged extremely high rates for the old and sick, and then banned the sick by using pre-existing conditions. And the adverse effect of that was that it drove the nonprofits to become exactly like them. Because if they remained in their traditional model with community rating, they would end up with all the sick people, and their rates would be extraordinarily high, and the for-profits would end up with all the healthy. So the name of the game was not to insure the sick. And this comes directly out of the for-profit model, because the board of directors of a for-profit insurance company's fiduciary responsibility is to maximize the income for the investor. And in healthcare, you do that three ways. You either screw the patient, screw the provider, and best screw both. So that gave us a healthcare system in which it was perverse. If you did not need insurance and were well and healthy, you could get it cheap. But if you needed insurance and were sick, you couldn't get it at all. So that's how it really started, and that's one of the pernicious problems with for-profit motives in health insurance. Mm-hmm. I would encourage you, if you want to be really educated on the profit motive in health insurance, to go to Bill Moyer's journal on the web and search for Wendell Potter.
Oh, yes.
There's a wonderful interview with Wendell. He was the VP for Cigna for PR, public relations, and he had to do things like put a good face on denying patients liver transplants and other procedures. And he also points out that the other side of the for-profit business is that Wall Street likes to see for-profit insurance companies spend not more than 80% of their revenue paying for claims. If you start creeping up over 80%, your stock price falls. And the way you maintain that is you dump your most expensive patients. And a classic example occurred with Aetna years ago when they bought two or three other companies. Their medical losses, that is, the percent of revenue that went for claims, started to creep above 80%. And their stock price was going through the toilet. So the company just dumped 8 million of their more expensive patients, and that brought their medical losses, which are payments for healthcare services that people need, in line with what Wall Street thought. So that's how we sort of, in this country, got to where we were prior to the passage of the bill. We had a perverse insurance system that insured only the sick. Well, and made it impossible for anyone with a chronic condition to get insurance. So, and it's hard to believe that you have the Tea Party types advocating for going back to that state. But that's what's going on. So basically what the bill does, it fixes a number of these problems. It looks very much like Mitt Romney's Massachusetts insurance system, in which it's based on a mixture of the not-for-profit insurance companies and for-profits. Now realize, in the bill, there are limits on the amount of money that you can skim off the top if you're a for-profit insurance company. If you offer insurance, group insurance, you have to spend 85% of your revenue on medical care and quality assurance procedures.
So this makes it across the board for all the insurance companies. So Wall Street can't punish if you're spending more than 80%. You
right.
have to spend 85% on health care.
There is wiggle room in that because it'll all sort of hinge on what you call a medical service, quality assurance, and that kind of thing. So you can expect a lot of wordsmithing and trying to slide as much of non-medical care or administrative expenses and call it medical care. So there'll be some of that. If they write individual policies, they have to spend 80% of their revenue. Now, this will be interesting because insurance companies like to do 75% on claims mm-hmm. and rake off the top 25%. And this is one of the problems in this bill. It kept these guys alive. So you immediately remove either 20% of the revenue for administrative costs and profit or 15% off the top, whereas Medicare's administrative costs are 3%. So you're paying a price to keep these companies alive.
And it's such a shame that in the whole debate, that was not made clearer or somehow got lost in a lot of other talks about freedom and socialism and, you know, other slogans that distracted people.
Yeah, the most important part to make this work is the requirement that everybody buy health insurance. And in doing this and making this requirement, there are a whole series of subsidies to help lower income people afford it. And there are also penalties if you choose to remain outside the system. Now, when Romney did the Massachusetts model, it has also mandatory requirements to purchase insurance with subsidies for those who can't afford it. He sold it as being an element of social responsibility. You have the responsibility to insure yourself and take care of your family. It's interesting how he sort of flip-flopped on this and what the right wing is doing. Although in Nixon's time and in the 90s, Republicans proposed mandatory insurance requirements. They just have conveniently forgotten that. So it seems hard to argue that you're going to be uninsured by choice, but yet you expect society to pick up your tab when you fall off a ladder and end up in the emergency room, and then you end up in as an inpatient, and if you're unlucky, you'll end up in an intensive care unit and walk away with a $200,000 or $300,000 bill.
Yeah.
And it's very irresponsible if you have an insurance system that makes insurance affordable for you to remain out of that system.
Yeah. So that the fact that it's mandatory and the Republicans are talking so much about freedom and government takeover, this is something that they themselves in other places and times supported and called it social responsibility.
Yeah.
Now they call it socialism.
Yeah. Well, that's but that's the name of politics.
Yes, it is.
Especially if you're running as the party of no.
Yes.
So the mandatory requirement is absolutely necessary to make insurance work.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have as many people in the pool as possible,
mm-hmm.
and that reduces the cost by increasing the denominator of the equation. And those people who choose to remain outside of it and don't support it actually contribute to the financial instability. UNC hospitals, for example, in this recession,
mm-hmm.
Its uncompensated care, according to its audit statements, has gone from about $50 million a year to $200 million.
Really?
And one of the benefits of insuring or getting more people into the insurance pool is for all providers, hospitals, and physicians' offices, your cost of uncompensated care will go down,
mm-hmm.
and that will get rid of some of the issues that drive the $80 aspirin and a $50 suture. You know, the prices in hospitals are fairly ethereal, and they include a large component of the uncompensated care,
okay.
and that drives cost up. So if you take 32 million people out of the uncompensated pool, you reduce a significant amount of cost pressure on the healthcare provider community. Now the problem is, if you leave another 16 million or so out, whether they be legal immigrants or illegal, and you still have the requirement that hospitals treat all comers,
mm-hmm.
then you're still going to have a significant component of uncompensated care in the system. You know, if I'm traveling in England and we're in an accident, I would be admitted to the National Health Service and no one would argue about whether I was an American or a citizen of the UK. They might work out issues later, but the acute care would be taken care of.
Yes, and I've heard other stories like that of Americans
in Germany or France.
Yeah, and getting wonderful care and being charged relatively
yeah.
little, if at all.
Yeah, so
so we have one of the problems that's left over is what you're saying is that whether it's legal or illegal immigrants, they're not part of the system, and that could cause a lot of uncompensated costs.
Yeah, and those who choose not to participate. One of the problems in the bill is the penalties for not participating in the system are relatively low and start off at $95. And eventually go by 2016 to 2.5% of income,
mm-hmm.
Up to $2,085 a year. You've got to have enough of a penalty to ensure that people participate.
Yes.
Otherwise, you end up picking up their tab, unless you're going to be draconian and say, if you're not in the system, you don't bleed in my ER.
Yeah,
and so no one is ready yet to do that, but it's the responsibility of the individual when there is a system of subsidies to participate in the program to make it work for society. If you're going to be an ultimate libertarian and be on your own, then you take responsibility for everything and you don't depend on the rest of society to bail you out when
yeah.
you get in trouble.
Yeah.
So that's part of the requirements. Let's see.
Well, that makes me think, though. Could a libertarian say, go to one of the insurance companies and just say they're going to buy their own insurance that would take care of everything and pay a whole lot more for it? Is that possible for them to opt out of the system by just paying for? I mean, would the insurance companies cooperate with that, or does everybody that's maybe a?
Well, if you're a Rockefeller.
Yeah.
Or I forget who owns Walmart.
It was Walton, Sam Walton.
Sam Walton and his heirs. You don't really need insurance.
You can simply
pay for everything.
Pay for it.
So if you're in the upper 5%,
yeah,
you could look at the cost benefit ratio, and if you have the funds to do it, you can opt out probably here and just pay the penalty.
Yeah.
As a cheaper alternative. But that's not the case in 95% of the rest of the people. If they opt out, they end up in an automobile accident. They'll end up in the hospital.
Yeah.
They could walk out with a $200,000 or $300,000 bill.
Yeah.
And then they could sign an agreement with UNC, for example, and pay $10 a month for the rest of their life. But in the meantime, that cost is added to everybody else's bill.
Yeah. So we've got to start thinking more in community terms, and that's something that has not been promoted very much, the
no.
general welfare. But I'm going to take a break right now and remind you that you're listening to WILP's Wake Up Call, WILP being the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and we're coming to you from WCOM-FM. And we have an underwriter, Internationalist Bookstore at 405 West Franklin Street, and you can get more information at internationalistbooks.org. I also just want to tell you a few things that are coming up that you might want to come to. On April 11th, this Sunday, at the Carborough Century Center at 4 o'clock, there's going to be a program looking at the recent Supreme Court decision undoing 50 years of restrictions or regulation on how much corporations can spend on political campaigns, so that we have at least still some power in electing our representatives, and they're not all totally corporate people. Gene Nichols, who's the former dean of the law school, will be talking. 4 o'clock, Carborough Century Center. I hope that you will come. And just one other one, on April 13th, there is going to be a senatorial forum. I think all of the candidates are expected to come, except maybe Richard Burr, but they're hoping he will come. And that'll be a chance to ask them questions and get a sense of who you want to vote for. And that's going to be at the Stone Center, which is on campus. Okay, we're talking about health care reform and very interesting history and the dynamics of money involved. And we're talking to Dr. John Hammond, Professor Emeritus from the UNC School of Medicine, who's been an activist on this issue for 15 years. Okay, John, where are we at now?
Okay, let's talk about some of the things in the bill.
Good.
The combination of everybody being required to buy insurance makes it possible to remove pre-existing conditions as an exclusion or a cause for producing insurance premiums that no one can afford. That is implemented by 2014. In the meantime, the bill encourages the creation of high-risk pools in states to make it possible for people to be covered before this kicks in. The problem, though, with high-risk pools is even though you have a larger group, it's your high risk, and insurance companies are not going to rush in my view, and offer reasonable insurance to a group of people that have great need and will require health care services. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But by 2014, annual limits on coverages are banned. You can't And also what goes in is a minimum standards for what an insurance policy is. Because one of the problems is that many people have bought insurance policies from for-profits that when they actually need it, find out that most of medical inpatient medical care is excluded, and what they thought they had boils down to nothing. So those kind of policies will be banned, and so you'll sort of have consumer protection in that there'll be standards for what a minimum policy can be.
Great.
And, of course, the libertarian says, why should I be forced to buy a policy that's effective? That's sort of an illogical, oxymoronic argument.
Or just, moronic, maybe.
Yeah, you're right. The other things that happen immediately, one thing that happens immediately is your children up to age 26 can remain on the parents' policy instead of being booted off at 20 or 21 or something like that. So that'll be a big help. A number of my friends have college-age kids, and this is one of the issues. They'll be able to keep the kid on the insurance policy rather than paying $1,200 or $1,600 a year in addition to college to provide student health insurance. The other thing that happens is kids are supposed to be not denied insurance because of pre-existing conditions right at the moment the bill passed. The for-profit insurance companies decided to quibble about the text in the bill, and they essentially to say that they didn't have to do it, but the PR disaster that was causing made it such that they recanted that claim. If you own a small business, this has always been one of the problems. I find it ironic that in Chapel Hill, the Chamber of Commerce members can't afford health insurance, so Brian Toomey of Piedmont Healthcare offers them primary care. Piedmont is designed for the poor and the uninsured or the underinsured, and here we have them providing care to the business community in Chapel Hill.
I had a great deal of difficulty with that because I go to that clinic and I wanted to get a grandkid in, and they for almost a year they were too filled up, although I'd read in the paper about them helping out the business community, and it was infuriating.
So this is I've had some correspondence with Aaron Nelson, the head of the chamber here. He says they don't have a very strong relationship with the national organization. I was particularly chagrined at the National Chamber of Commerce fighting tooth and nail against health insurance reform when one of their own chapters is using health care services for the poor. It just seemed something that should be well publicized.
Yes, I think he tries to disassociate himself from that, but still and all.
So anyhow, what the bill provides, it's trying to help small companies provide workers insurance, and there are tax credits for companies that have 25 or fewer employees and have an average age of 50,000 or less. The tax credits are up to 35% of the cost of premiums, will be available this year, and will reach 50% of the cost of premiums by 2014.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So that encourages private businesses to insure their workers. If firms have more than 50 employees and don't offer coverage, they pay a penalty of $2,000 per employee if any of their workers get government-subsidized coverage in the insurance exchanges that will be set up.
Oh, okay.
The first 30 workers will be excluded from the assessment. If you're over 65, I'm 64, the Medicare Advantage program, if you go to the North Carolina Department of Insurance and you talk to the counselors who deal with senior health care insurance questions, this has been the biggest fraud perpetrated on this population. The private insurance agents were paid a substantial premium to sign people up, and they have in North Carolina signed people up for Medicare Advantage where no hospital in their area or no physician will take that insurance. But the agent walks away with the $600 for everybody signed up. It's almost like the liar loans and the mortgage meltdown. But anyway, so And the other problem is that Medicare Advantage programs cost Medicare 114%, 14% more than regular Medicare. Mm-hmm. And it truly has been a ripoff. And the benefits of eye exam and glasses surely don't outweigh the costs. And this is essentially a program set up by Bush to conform with his ideology of the government shouldn't be in insurance and the private sector can do it better. We're bribing the private sector to provide insurance to an adverse selected population that they never wanted in the first place. So, and then I really love the Medicare people who are on Medicare who say, take your hands off my Medicare. it's a government insurance program. It's yes. A very good one. Yes. And one of the things that the physician community has learned over the years, that it's much harder to get a claim paid by a for-profit insurance company, that Medicare and Medicaid, although they don't pay as high rate, they pay. You know what you're going to get.
Yes.
And so you're not constantly arguing for your reimbursement. And that, I think, is one of the basic reasons the AMA did not fight health insurance reform tooth and nail they did in 1965. They have now had the experience of dealing with for-profit insurance, and they now have many people employed in their office to hop through the hoops of the for-profit insurance companies. Let's see.
Well, I'm so glad you're telling us some of the real positive things. And
The future would be.
Thank you, Dick.
Will be
Dick
interesting.
Paddock, our engineer, I forgot to mention.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with the for-profit insurance companies if they truly are limited to skimming 15% to 20% off the top and can't do 25% or 30%. We'll see if they don't decide that they should return to their core business products of life insurance, car insurance, home insurance, and that health insurance is too risky and we should probably leave it up as a right of citizenship and a government entity providing insurance like a single payer system would be the cheapest administrative
yes.
cost of all. And I was sort of hoping that it would be there so that as the for-profits bow out, there would be an orderly transition. We'll just have to see what happens.
What about Grayson's Medicare buy-in bill?
Oh, for people less than 65? The other option talked about was Medicare for all. There's no reason why you couldn't just drop the age and just pick up people. It's already in place, and it uses the private sector as the billing and claims processing. Blue Cross Blue Shield processes claims not only for the state plan, but for Medicare. So you're not exactly putting them out of business. You're just reducing the rake off from the top.
Yes. So there is still some hope. Is Grayson's bill is still in alive there? It's still.
Yeah, he had 80 co-sponsors.
Yeah. I think that I wouldn't hold my breath because this has been such a painful process
mm-hmm.
that I don't think anybody's going to be willing to open up too many issues. But it's the opposition to this bill is illogical, immoral, and unethical.
Yes,
in everything that they have done. They have truly lied blatantly, and they continue to lie blatantly. So. And it's been interesting to see reform and repeal this bill sort of morph. And I expect over time it'll morph more.
So we're not home free. So we're running out of time. Yeah. We have a minute left. And I want to...
Kaiser Healthcare News.
Okay, John.
You should go to kaiserhealthcare.org just Google Kaiser Family Foundation or Kaiser, and you'll get a great... unbiased source of good information on health insurance reform.
So go there if you want to continue understanding our new reform bill, which has a lot of very positive things in it. And if you want to find out more about the Women's International League, go to trianglewilf.org. WYLPF, and we're brought to you by WCOM-FM, and you can go to WCOMFM.org to find out more about that, and it's WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Thank you. This is Lori Hoyt, your host, and Dick Paddock, your engineer, saying bye-bye. Have a good weekend.